Was there classified information on former Congressman Wiener's computer?
Yes.
Who sent it to him?
His then-spouse, Huma Abedin, appears to have had a regular practice of forwarding emails to him, for him, I think, to print out for her, so she could then deliver them to the Secretary of State.
Former FBI Director James Comey at a Senate hearing last week. Earlier today, the FBI notified Congress that Comey had made mistakes in that testimony. And this afternoon, White House spokesman Sean Spicer said, quote, "The president has accepted the recommendation of the attorney general and the deputy attorney general regarding the dismissal of the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation." In other words, James Comey was fired. Here to talk about that and the circumstances around it is Justin Levitt, law professor at Loyola Law School. He's also a former deputy assistant attorney general in the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department under President Obama. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, you have read a letter, a memo, I should say, for the attorney general that the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, prepared for him, explaining exactly why James Comey should be fired. And in it, he talks a lot about how Comey handled the Clinton emails. And what do you make of that, that someone in the Trump White House is basically saying that Comey should be fired for the way he handled the Clinton emails?
It's unusual, I think, at first, and I think everybody can appreciate it as unusual. Certainly, directors of the FBI have been let go or have been offered the chance to resign in the past, but there's an awful lot of controversy around the FBI. There has been since shortly before the election, and what you're seeing now is, I think, that controversy coming to a head. I think that the letter, yes, the memo from the Deputy Attorney General to the Attorney General seems to suggest that Director Comey was out of line in his handling of the Clinton email affair. And that's the primary reason given for his dismissal. I think that suggestion would find a lot of agreement across the political spectrum. It's just rather unusual for it to happen now.
Right. So Democrats were calling for Comey to be fired a long time ago, and he could have been. I guess President Obama could have fired him, but declined to. Was there a discussion while you were there in the Attorney General's office that Comey should go?
That's certainly not anything that I can talk about, what happened sort of behind closed doors at the DOJ then, but I think it's certainly fair to acknowledge that in the public, there were lots of calls for statements about whether what Comey had done was proper or improper, and certainly there was lots of public concern that he be retained or let go. The president actually had kept a previous director of the FBI on. So President Obama had kept Robert Mueller, mm-hmm. who was the former director of the FBI, on since 2001. He'd been the director when President Obama took office. He retained him in his post. James Comey came in 2013. And I think the president, without disclosing any conversations behind closed doors, I think the way that he traded Director Mueller shows that he valued consistency in that office. The office of the FBI director has a 10-year tenure that was set after J. Edgar Hoover had held the office for decades. But the 10-year tenure is very carefully calibrated to span presidential administrations. And I think the default thumb on the scale, as you see from the way President Obama handled FBI Director Mueller when he took office, the default thumb on the scale is to keep an FBI director in place, again, across administrations. I think that likely weighed in his decision.
So going back to this memo from Rod Rosenstein, he carefully lays out the reasons of all the missteps that Comey made leading up to his testimony, and then the fact that he didn't really seem that apologetic during the testimony or didn't seem to think that he did much wrong. He was mildly nauseous, not severely nauseous, that he may have affected the presidential race. But what is not spoken of is the fact that the FBI is investigating the Trump campaign for possible ties to Russia. And so does that raise any issues for you?
It certainly raises issues. That, too, is rather unusual to have an FBI investigation now disclosed, not of the president, but of Russian interference in the 2016 election, and including any connections to the Trump campaign and or the Trump White House. That is, needless to say, an unusual circumstance. That investigation does not depend on Director Comey and does not start or stop with his hiring or firing. So the investigation continues until it comes to a conclusion. And I have absolutely no doubt that it will continue now that, Director Comey is gone. I also have no doubt that whomever is chosen to succeed Director Comey, you know, that's a president-nominated, Senate-confirmed position, and I have to imagine that that's going to be an enormous topic of confirmation hearings when a new director is named.
I want to play a clip of tape right now of Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, and he gave a very brief news conference just a few hours ago.
This is part of a deeply troubling pattern from the Trump administration. They fired Sally Yates. They fired Preet Bharara. And now they fired Director Comey, the very man leading the investigation.
And I want to bring in Michael Grunwald now, senior writer for Politico. What is the political fallout right now in terms of this firing in Washington?
Well, of course, you know, you never want to predict on these things, but I think Democrats were already super fired up about the whole Russia investigation. I mean, this has been, you know, it's been pretty extraordinary what's come out in the last few months. I mean, it wasn't like with Watergate where you had these low-level burglars and then it was kind of drip, drip, drip. Here you had the president's national security advisor was fired after just 3 weeks, and one of his campaign managers was also had to acknowledge that he was an unregistered foreign agent for a Russian ally. So I think, you know, there was already some blood in the water, and this, you know, it's going to look bad. I mean, the letters from the Department of Justice were all dated today. The president got them, immediately fired. It certainly has the feel of something that was ginned up. He wanted to fire the guy running the investigation. And certainly Democrats are going to push that argument.
Even though this memo, again, as I mentioned by Rod Rosenstein, doesn't mention that at all. I mean, it mentions the Clinton email. Are some people saying, oh, that's just cover?
Well, I think the, you know, the mishandling of, you know, the sort of grave injustices that that are alleged in the Justice Department letter that Comey allegedly, you know, perpetrated on Hillary Clinton had never before today been a subject of real concern in the Trump operation, I think it's fair to say. I mean, they were yelling, you know, lock her up. And there's certainly, now certainly a lot of Democrats had complained about some of the things that were mentioned in this letter. But May 9th is a weird day to fire an FBI director for the, something that happened during the campaign, presumably January 21st would have been a perfectly good opportunity.
But could the tipping point have been his testimony last week, and it took a week for Rod Rosenstein to, you know, craft his argument, his legal argument?
Sure. I mean, I guess anything's possible. I mean, you know, certainly as a, you know, in terms of credibility, as you know, he hasn't earned a lot of credibility on this issue, and even Trump's letter to Comey was super weird, where the second paragraph, you know, went out of the way to emphasize that that Comey had told Trump that he was not under investigation, which if that were true would have been a, I think your other guests can say, but that would be kind of a pretty serious violation of Justice Department guidelines about communications with the White House.
Yeah. So he says, while I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation, I nevertheless concur with the judgment of the Department of Justice that you are not able to effectively lead the Bureau. Justin Levitt, is
sort
that
of
some...
apropos of nothing?
Yeah. Yeah. By the way. So Justin Levitt, would Comey do that? Would he actually say that to Donald Trump when he's investigating his campaign for possible ties to Russia? Would he say that you are not under investigation?
The FBI does not normally let you know if you are under investigation or not under investigation. They talk to you, they gather evidence, they mount investigations, and they either forward them for prosecution or they conclude them. It is highly unusual to inform someone that they either are or are not. I also say, I mean, as your other guest said, it is profoundly weird that the president would include that information in a letter that does not otherwise have to do with, at least purportedly, the FBI's investigation of any connection to Russia or otherwise any investigation of the current White House occupants. But I'll also say that this president has exaggerated in the past, particularly on matters with very specific legal connotations. And the director was very, very specific in saying when he testified that there is an investigation into Russia's conduct with respect to the 2016 election. And that includes contacts that Russia may have had with individuals connected to the Trump campaign, that the investigation at least stretched that far. He did not say that he had ruled out any further participation by any individual on that campaign. And I would be very surprised if he had affirmatively ruled out any individual, made that conclusion, and hadn't announced it.
What about the idea that firing James Comey could amount to obstruction of justice if James Comey is investigating you?
The president has the power to dismiss individuals who serve at his pleasure, and the FBI director is one of those individuals. It is certainly not escaping anybody's notice that the FBI director has been fired. And so you can expect there to be an awful lot of attention on the circumstances. I also think that, again, it does not directly impact any ongoing investigations around Trump or not around Trump. There will be an acting director of the FBI, and there will be the career men and women at the FBI who are not politically appointed and who are actually conducting whatever investigation is being conducted. And so, I don't think if the intent was to throw the investigation off the rails to the extent there is one, I don't think it's likely to be effective because it's not actually affecting the investigation. It is certainly removing the most prominent individual in the FBI, but the career men and women who are in the service continue investigations whether or not their current leader has been in place.
But presumably, could the incoming head of the FBI shut down the investigation?
That is certainly possible. That is also something that I would think would have an enormous amount of attention directed at it through the confirmation process.
Right.
That is, I would be shocked if the Senate did not take up exactly that question when seeking to confirm whoever is chosen to replace Director Comey.
But Michael Grunwald of Politico, it doesn't take 60 votes to confirm the next director of the FBI, just 51, correct?
That's right. And remember, I mean, for example, you know, during his confirmation hearing or after the confirmation hearing, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, said he was recusing himself from the Russia investigation, but he did just recommend the firing of the guy in charge of it. So I think, you know, President Trump has been extremely brazen about this stuff. He clearly, I mean, you know, we can speculate about what the, about what, you know, gosh, this is crazy politics. You know, how could he send a tweet telling senators to what to ask Sally Yates when she's testifying, trying to change the subject? How could he, you know, put these things on his Twitter account saying that, you know, the entire Russia investigation is a hoax? But he's clearly made a decision that saying that this is all bogus is in his interest. And, you know, clearly the letter that he sent to Director Comey suggests that this is part of his effort to say that this is all bogus. And I guess if you want to give him the benefit of the doubt from a, you know, on a substantive level, if you really did think this was all bogus, maybe that's a reason to fire the guy in charge of a bogus investigation. But it does happen to be of the president's own campaign.
Chuck Schumer calling for a special prosecutor today. Others have called for that in the past. Do you think that that now picks up steam? And can Jeff Sessions get away with not appointing a special prosecutor now?
Well, he got away with you know, telling during his confirmation hearings, he said that he had no contact with the Russians. And then, never, you know, it came out pretty quickly that that wasn't true, which was kind of a big major issue and then suddenly disappeared. And I'm not sure why. Everybody just decided, I guess, that was not a big deal. So I'm not in the business of saying that they can't get away with anything. There have been a lot of really spectacular, you know, sort of pretty flagrant violations of longstanding norms that you know, you wouldn't necessarily say it's without consequence. He's the least popular president ever at this period in his presidency, but it's certainly, you know, they've made the calculation that they can get away with this stuff.
Michael Grunwald, senior writer for Politico. Justin Levitt, a professor of law at Loyola Law School. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anytime, Adeline.
Coming up, City Councilman Gil Cedillo joins us to talk about an unexpectedly tough re-election fight that is really about gentrification. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In what would normally be a sleepy election, there is an unexpectedly exciting runoff next week in a Los Angeles City Council race. It's bike activist Joe Bray Ali versus incumbent Gil Cedillo in District 1, which covers parts of Northeast LA, including Eagle Rock and Highland Park. That district is pretty much the face of the gentrification battle here in Los Angeles. Home prices in Highland Park, for example, have gone up 15% in the last year, pushing long-term rent out. But adding to the interest in this race, Joe Bray Ali has been the center of a scandal. He posted racist and demeaning comments on a website and admitted to having extramarital affairs. The LA Times rescinded its endorsement of Joe Bray Ali. And joining us now in the studio is the incumbent, Gil Cedillo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, nice to have you. I just want to play a clip of tape from Joe Bray Ali. He spoke with KCRW last week, and he explained that he is staying in the race, and here's why.
The reason that I am here is because we have an incumbent who has been a very poor servant in this district. People have criticized me for being inexperienced. They've criticized me for having no money, having no political friends, not being savvy enough, not being good enough. And yet here I am, able to push this incumbent into a runoff. It has really been his race to lose.
So how do you respond to that, that this is your race to lose and that he has pushed you into a runoff?
He's hardly a neophyte. His father's a political consultant. He's well aware of how politics work. His first job out of college, his father called up a state assembly member and got him a job so that he can go learn the trade. His father remains a consultant for the state Senate. So he's hardly a neophyte. He's hardly a citizen Joseph, as he would like to portray himself.
Still, he's saying that this has been a pretty tough race and that usually incumbents face little to no significant opposition. And in this case, you have faced significant opposition. Why is that?
One, there's a tremendous clamor, a desire for change in the nation. Two, I think, and I'll accept this as a criticism, that we need to do more, my office, to communicate the tremendous work that we're doing for our district. And while you did focus on the Northeast, there's also the other part of the district, the part that's 85% immigrant, the part that's significantly undocumented.
This is Pico Union.
Pico Union, mm-hmm. Normandy and Venice, Normandy and Olympic. This is Washington and Magnolia. This is over by University Village. And so our district is very diverse, multilingual. And in those parts of the district, we're really popular.
You said that you've learned that you need better communications
yes.
with your constituents.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the complaints have been that you have been absent, out of touch. You haven't met with constituents. They can't get their phone calls returned. Is that what you're talking about in terms of better communication?
That's part of it. Part of it is that we do a lot of great work. The number of parks that we're opening up is really impressive.
But what about this idea that some constituents have that you're not meeting with them, you're not talking to them, you're not hearing from them? What about that?
Right. And I think that's very important. I've heard that during the campaign, and we're going to work to improve that. But there's also, let me put this on the table for people. You have to understand that my district, you've got to speak about five or six languages. There are places like Pico Union and Venice and Olympic, Venice and Normandy, Venice and Normandy, Olympic and Normandy. There's a whole corridor down Washington Boulevard. I mean, there's a lot of places that you won't hear that complaint. You're going to hear that we're there, our Friday night movies. You're going to hear that we've got our concerts. You're going to hear that we're there at church on Sundays.
So you're saying that's just one part of part of your constituency that's complaining?
Yes.
And the other part is just fine, that you don't have a problem with communication with the other part of the district?
Yes.
So is it that you don't communicate with one part of the district, or that they just complain more?
People have different expectations, and clearly, I think if we reflect on where I've been over the last 4 years, there's a community that of greater need in the more southern part of our district, and we try to be responsive to that. Parts of our challenges is to make sure that people vote and are enabled to vote.
But why is it that the Los Angeles Times endorsed Joe Braille before the scandal broke and then rescinded its endorsement? He said Joe Braille presents fresh ideas grounded in reality and a clear commitment to the district and its issues.
He is articulate. He impressed them with the things he said. But all they had to do was challenge him, you know, just go a little one inch deeper. And they would find that he was not all the things that he said he was. And they found that out, much to their embarrassment, much to their chagrin, and have abandoned him, as everybody, as his hedge funder from New York has abandoned him, as Mitchell Farrell has abandoned him, as the environmental community has abandoned him, because they found him to be a charlatan, a fraud.
Right.
A good one, capable, but one nevertheless.
But what about the underlying issues that he raises and that this campaign has raised, and that is the underlying issue of housing prices, gentrification, some long-term renters who can no longer afford to live in their neighborhoods because of rapidly rising housing prices. And your opponents have said that you have not done enough to fight that.
Yeah. So, major issue in the city, housing. We need 100,000 units of housing. Our district is doing its share. Over 3,000 new units of housing has been built. 66% of those units, 2,100 units of housing, 2,100 new units of housing have been affordable. There's much more to do. There's no question about that. We've got a lot to do. It's a crisis. We've recognized we have to build housing for the homeless. We have to make sure that there's an abundance of housing for everybody.
And clearly, how do you plan to do that? And do you support legislation that would, for example, require developers to set aside a certain amount of units as affordable?
We don't like to be that prescriptive, but we recognize that that's one of the strategies.
But would you support that or not?
We're happy to have it, but I don't want people to think that that's the panacea, because that only produces at the maximum 400 units annually. We need a lot more than
that. So what's a better idea then?
Better idea is to pursue these very aggressively with developers, create the conditions and circumstances so we can create abundant housing. Here's our strategy. Take advantage of property that the city has, the county has, the Metro has, that the community colleges have. Use that property, take HHH money, take Measure H, bring that together with experienced, great developers like people who do affordable housing downtown. Work with them, then do working with the community through a community process. Find the places that we can begin to build the housing that's affordable, deals with the question of homelessness, and then work our way up from there. But also, we have to build market rate, because there are people, young college graduates, professionals, et cetera, who also need a place to live. If they don't have housing available to them, they're going to be looking at the affordable housing that's throughout the city.
Now, I understand you have taken campaign donations from developer Jeff Palmer?
Yes.
Okay. He has led the charge against requiring developers to include affordable housing in their developments. He's known for big developments in the downtown area that are pretty controversial. Why do you take money from him?
Well, I took one check from him in the beginning of the first primary. I take money from developers to fund my campaign because people in my district aren't as capable of providing resources for my campaign. I think the next question to ask, though, is what's the influence? What's the impact? This question came up at a community meeting. Weigh the impact of all the funding that I get, and then tell me one vote of the hundreds of thousands of votes that I've taken that have demonstrated that I've been influenced by that money. And there's not one.
Well, he would be against a requirement that would require developers to include affordable housing in their developments. And you have just said that that's not exactly a great tool in the toolbox.
Well, it is a tool. And I'm not saying it's not a great tool. It's just not a panacea. 400 units, we need more than that. I appreciate his donation, but it's not going to influence my vote. I think it's important to note that our working with him has produced more housing. He works with unions, and he's more open to these types of suggestions than he was in the past.
How would you help a renter stay in his or her apartment at an affordable rate?
We've created a rent registry. We want to fortify the rent control ordinance. We want to relook at the Alice Act. We want to relook at the buyout agreements. We have to basically get a clean sheet and look at what are the things that we can do to protect and stabilize these communities and then continue to build housing. But we have to create some stability for renters. The laws are outdated. The laws are, you know, from the 70s and the 80s. Rent control units have to be before 77. So a lot of the concerns...
So would you favor rewriting that?
Yes,
to
absolutely.
Update it to when? What date? Present date? Going forward?
Or? You know, I'd have to, you know, see what we could get done in Sacramento and where the governor's at. I've had this conversation with the governor. I've had it with the president pro tem. This is part of a two-year bill that we're going to look at. And so I do support that. But we also have to build, as you know, more housing as well. And so we want to figure out how we can do both.
Is that something you can do at the city level?
Not completely at the city level, no. It needs some support from Sacramento.
A large part of your district, I imagine, many of the residents are undocumented mm-hmm. or are related to undocumented mm-hmm. residents. What is your stance on Los Angeles being a sanctuary city?
I support it. I don't want one person deported who is hardworking, who's taking care of his family, who's integrated into the social fabric of our community, who's part of the foundation of our economy. I think that's unnecessarily disruptive. I think what we should do is what I did in the past with respect to driver's licenses. We should change the law to accommodate our reality.
Gil Cedillo, he is facing a runoff election for his seat in District 1 next Tuesday. Councilman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, an LA artist who shocked the art world.
And in your mind, that was the sculpture, the result of you being shot.
No, just the moment when I was getting shot was the sculpture. Just that instant when the bullet traveled from the gun into my arm.
A new documentary on LA artist Chris Burden. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The lampposts at LACMA have become a Los Angeles icon and a symbol of the art establishment here. But the creator of that Instagram-friendly installation is a man whose work originally sparked confusion and anger. Chris Burden made a name for himself in 1971 when he hired a guy to shoot him in the arm for the sake of performance art.
And I see it in my mind to stand there and have somebody shoot me. It seemed a very powerful sculpture.
He also nailed himself to a car in Venice Beach. Those nails went through his hands. And he held a knife to an interviewer on live television. All of this is in the new documentary, Burden. The directors of the film are here now, Tim Marinan and Rich Dewey. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Well, why were you interested in doing a documentary on Chris Burden?
We really thought it was one of the great untold stories of the art world. And as you alluded to, he had this really interesting early career mm-hmm. with these transgressive performances that shook the art world, and a very interesting transition to a later career with these massive civic sculptures that were heartwarming and invited children to look and play with them. So we just thought that that story and his personal arc was really fascinating.
Mm. Well, let's go back to 1971 when he's talking about that piece of him being shot. And can you just set it up? He actually didn't do it in public, right?
That's right. It was at a space called F Space, which was a warehouse in Santa Ana that was rented by a number of MFA art students from UC Irvine.
So somehow it gets out that he did this, and he's invited to talk about it on TV. Regis Philbin, you have a clip in your movie, is interviewing him, a young Regis. Let's listen.
You allowed someone to shoot you.
Right.
With a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in your mind, that was the sculpture, the result of you being shot.
No, just the moment when I was getting shot was the sculpture. Just that instant when the bullet traveled from the gun into my arm.
Uh-huh. Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was a good piece.
Yeah, but who could appreciate it?
You do.
Well, I can appreciate that.
I mean, that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here because of that piece.
So it's interesting how he had this awareness of publicity and that being part of the art project.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, he did this piece at this place, F Space in Santa Ana. He did it for a very small number of people. And it actually took a while for word of it to spread. It got picked up by Esquire magazine. They printed an article about Chris and about that piece. And it became kind of a sensation and got him a lot of mainstream press beyond just the art press. And, you know, he kind of saw how people reacted to that. And it led to things like that Regis interview. You know, I think Regis was pretty dubious at the start of that interview about this young guy who was doing these crazy performance pieces. And that was the reaction of a lot of the mainstream press at that time. And I think as Chris continued making performances, he got a little bit disillusioned with how he was being portrayed in the press as this kind of wild man doing these crazy stunts. And that really wasn't how he saw them.
What, how did he see them?
I think he spent a lot of time preparing these pieces. So, for instance, shoot, the gentleman who shot him, Bruce Dunlap, spent 3 weeks practicing shooting against the wall with an outline of a human figure. So Chris drew on his training as a minimalist artist in designing and thinking about these pieces, and they took a very long time to come about. And he thought a lot about the documentation, the photographs that would be taken, and how the pieces would exist on another level as a story and a myth. So I think he thought they were very different from someone like Evel Knievel or a stuntman doing these sort of stunts out in front of the public, like jumping the Grand Canyon on a dirt bike or something in that vein.
So he was actually compared to Evel Knievel.
He was. That was kind of a tag that was given to him in those days. He was called the Evel Knievel of art, and it was something that was sort of repeated in the mainstream press. And I think it was something that frustrated him.
Evel Knievel and I are two completely different people. I'm about art, and I'm about trying to do a quality thing in art. And Evel Knievel does the same thing over. He's a stuntman kind of, or, you know, he's a trickster. And I'm not a trickster. Like, everything I do is for real.
He never repeated his pieces. He would do these things. He, you know, he had an idea of something he wanted to explore. In shoot, it was the idea of getting shot. I mean, he says in our film, being shot is as American as apple pie.
Everybody has fantasized about being shot, either consciously or subconsciously. And you read about it, you see it on TV, and you see it in the news. And so everybody, especially in America, thinks about it a lot. As American as apple pie.
You know, this was done in the 70s when the Vietnam War was happening, where there were student protests. You know, there was violence as part of the culture. He wanted to explore that by experiencing getting shot himself. But once he'd done it, he had, you know, he'd been through that process. He'd experienced what he wanted to experience. He'd maybe answered some questions, and he didn't go around and repeat them. So it wasn't a case of kind of, you know, then doing it 10 times in different places to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. So he really saw himself as distinct from that.
But there was a consistent theme in some of that earlier work of masochism, or at least pushing his body to the limits. So there's that being shot. He also, when he was in graduate school, I don't know how he did it, but he folded himself up into a 2x2 square foot locker and stayed there for 5 days. He lay on the floor of a gallery for days without food or water. As I said in the introduction, he nailed himself to a car through his hands. So what was he trying to explore by putting his body in such extreme situations and hurting himself?
I think there were a lot of different aspects to it. You know, he tells a story in our film about getting injured as a child. He had an injury with a motorcycle, and he had to spend several weeks in bed recuperating. And he talks about the idea of control and wanting to try and take control of his own destiny. And I think you see him in those pieces playing with how much can you control a situation? What are the limits to that?
I broke my leg, had a major thing. I got
spent a year in the hospital. My mother's boyfriend's Vespa turned over my foot. Well, that maybe now I've got control over it.
Uh-huh. At least you're using it.
Yeah.
And also sometimes he's putting the control in the hands of the audience. In one piece, he lay attached to the floor and there were buckets of water nearby with electrical wires going in there. So people could come into that room and walk around. And if someone chose to kick over that water or knocked it over accidentally, you know, he could be electrocuted. So he was sort of playing with the idea of what are the limits of control. He was also looking at the idea of putting the viewers under pressure. What's the reasonable response to seeing someone do these pieces? You know, should you call the police? Should you sort of try and intervene and help? Or do you stand away because it's an art piece and you don't touch the art?
It's just an energy situation. People come in and immediately they're aware of the implications. So what happens is they don't even go near the buckets. I'm not about death and I didn't want to die, but I wanted to come close, okay, in a sense.
He approached them in a kind of scientific way, I think. It's something you see play out in his later works. He started making sculptures and installations that had an element of science and engineering in them. But even in the performances, he kind of approached them with this blank piece of paper, a proposition that he wanted to investigate, and then kind of going through from first principles, carrying that idea right through as far as it could go. And sometimes that was pushing his body to the limits, his mind to the limit. He did a lot of durational pieces where he would spend a long time in one place. Or as you say, when he spent 5 days crammed into a locker, which was actually his graduate piece at UC Irvine when he was still an art student.
I just want to play a clip of tape from your movie of a British art critic who isn't really down with what he's doing.
Performance art, it's new, but that doesn't make it art. It only makes a thing that silly people go to see.
Well, he certainly says no. So was that the view at a certain time, or is that the view now of what he did back then, that it didn't really qualify as real art?
I think that was certainly a more prevalent view at the time when Chris was doing these performances. I think Chris faced a lot of opposition from the establishment, from the art establishment. And I think that view has really changed as time has gone by. I think the establishment view now accepts these performances, sees them as seminal pieces of art, and they're in the art history books. So I think the view that Brian Sewell expresses in our film was very much what Chris encountered when he was doing the performance, but today it would be very much a minority view, I think, within the art world.
So, but still, he decided to give up performance art because he saw it as too limiting, or that people were just categorizing him as a certain kind of artist and not taking him seriously?
I think that was certainly part of it. You know, I think he was getting frustrated with how he was being characterized. But I think also for him, to be honest, it was just kind of an organic shift. He moved into sculpture, but for him, he always considered the performances actually to be works of sculpture, just sculpture using his body as the raw material. There's a lot of practical considerations to it as well. When he was a student getting out of art school, he didn't necessarily have the space and the money for these materials that you might make large-scale sculptures with. After a while of working as an artist, he moved up to Topanga Canyon. He bought some land up there in the late 70s. And over a number of years, he built up his studio and his home up there. And that was a kind of free space where he had the literal space as well as the headspace to kind of move in new directions. And as you say, he moved into making sculptures. Towards the end of his career, as you say, pieces like Urban Light, Metropolis 2, which have become so well known here in Los Angeles.
And that is the installation, the permanent installation at LACMA. It's basically a city, I suppose, with tons of cars moving through on these tracks.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a model of Los Angeles in a way. It's thousands of little modified Hot Wheel cars running on these plastic tracks. It's very frenetic. You kind of have to go and see it to really appreciate it. You know, it's kind of Chris reflecting, I think, in a way on his time in Los Angeles. He was an artist who was based here from when he was a student. He was very important to the LA art scene and the development of the LA art scene, and LA was also very important to him in influencing his work.
And it was interesting for us going up to his studio and visiting and watching Metropolis take shape over years of development, and within this beautiful landscape of Topanga, very rural, very rustic, inside of this building.
How long did it take him to build that?
I think it was five years. five to six years, maybe. And then there was a component of it was finished, but then it took, I think, about a year to take it apart in his studio, transport it down the hill from Topanga, and then install it in LACMA.
Those lampposts have really become iconic, like the Hollywood sign now, almost. Did he ever think that that would happen? Or what was his reaction to that when he saw that actually happening?
He was really pleased, I think. Yeah, I think that gave him a lot of pleasure. And, you know, one of the things that he says in our film is that people go along and look at those lampposts and they have no idea that he's the artist and that it's the same person who did all those performances back in the 70s. And that actually kind of gave him a lot of pleasure to know that the piece existed beyond him and you know, would outlive him. So I think he really got a lot out of how much it was embraced by Los Angeles. And as you say, it's really become a landmark for the city.
I go by there sometimes at 1:30 at night. There's people in there taking pictures and frolicking and making out and kids bouncing off the lamps. They are not about me as an individual artist or my creation as an artist. People just enjoy them and they get great pleasure from them. They could care less who the artist is. In a certain way, that's fine for me because it means that the artwork is bigger than the maker.
And he died unexpectedly. People didn't know he was sick last year. And he was working up until pretty much the moment he died, right?
He was, yeah. He wasn't sick when we started the project, so it was a completely unexpected thing from our point of view. He kept the news very private just to close family and friends, so it was a shock to a lot of people in the art world and beyond when he passed away. And yeah, he was working right up to the end. The final piece that he made, which we documented the creation of, was a piece called Ode to Santos Dumont. It's a sort of model blimp that floats around the room, and he finished that shortly before he passed away. And ultimately, it was exhibited at LACMA just a few days after he died. So it was quite a poignant event.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Tim Maranin and Rich Dewey. They're the directors of the new movie, Burden. The film comes out in theaters on Friday, May 12th at the New Art here in Santa Monica and in Orange County at the Regency South Coast Village. Coming up on this program, we're going to give you your dessert. Yes, your guide to the best pie in Los Angeles. It is a biased guide for sure, but that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This Saturday is National Apple Pie Day. You didn't know that? Okay. Admittedly, it is a bit of a loose news peg, but an excuse to talk about pie. So we're not going to limit ourselves to apple pie. There are many others. And here to tell us who is serving the best pie in Los Angeles is our regular food expert, Catherine Spires. Hi.
Hi.
The best pie in Los Angeles. I mean, I'm sure no one agrees on that.
No, of course, it's a great thing to get in a fight about. Absolutely.
Okay. So let's go for apple pie first.
Apple pie. Well, you have your classics, frankly. You have pie and burger and mm-hmm. the apple pan.
Pasadena.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pie and burger is Pasadena and the apple pan in Westwood. It's called the apple pan. You're going to get an apple pie there. Although, I must say that if you're less of an apple pie person, the banana cream pie there is pretty excellent as well.
Yeah, their pies are incredible. So do they do all butter crusts or no?
Yeah. Yeah,
they do.
That's like the standard crust, and that brings us into the issue of does the crust make the pie? Does the pie make the crust? What counts as a pie? All of that sort of issue. Growing up, I thought it was double crust, fruit pies, that was it. But then I learned about cream pies and chess pies and pecan pies. So many different varieties.
Well, for you, is it filling or crust?
I have decided that it is about the crust. But then you get into the issue of the graham cracker crust. Listen, it's an endless discussion about what constitutes a pie. I have decided that cheesecake is pie, and This is going to sound weird, but House of Pies makes an excellent cheesecake.
Huh.
It's a little rundown spot in Los Feliz. They're a classic diner. They make really good, especially with the strawberry topping. It's excellent.
It's kind of hard not to make a good cheesecake.
Oh, I would hope so. Can you imagine
a bad
cheesecake?
You can get a good one at Trader Joe's in the frozen section.
Trader Joe's does good work.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, so best crust in town for you?
Yeah, that one. And then I am a big fan of Jungavard's Bake and Broil, and that is in Long Beach. They make good pies all year round. But in the late spring, early summer months, you have to call ahead and make sure that they have the Olalla berry pie. And an Olalla berry is a hybrid berry that has a very short growing season and is very delicate, and hardly anyone grows it commercially. But Jungavard's, I believe, buys up almost the entire stock of it to make these pies that people lose their minds over. Again, please call ahead. Don't go there expecting to get the pie because it might have already sold out. But it is probably a Southern California treasure.
Jungavard's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell that?
J-O-N-G-E-W-A-A-R-D.
I would not have thought that that was the spelling.
Good thing we spelled it.
I know. Good thing. Okay. Southern pies. You mentioned you like your Chess.
Yes, absolutely. Which is essentially just a custard pie. You want to get some sugar and eggs and butter and mm-hmm. mix them together and pour it into a pie crust. Voila.
Also, it doesn't seem that hard, but.
No. But, you know, there's has to be some love and some mm-hmm. magic into it as well. But Gus's Fried Chicken. They have fried chicken in the name, but people are really starting to pay attention to their desserts because they make really good pies. Southern pies, which is something that we don't get as much of in Los Angeles. They make sweet potato pie, pecan pie. They make Chess pies both in the quote-unquote regular plain flavor and then the chocolate variety as well. They also make a coconut pie that people are really going nuts for. It's not a coconut cream pie. It's a custard with the coconut mixed in, and then it's topped with shredded coconut that I believe is torched as well. So it's a really intense coconut flavor that I highly recommend if you're a fan of coconut.
Yum. That sounds so good.
Yeah.
All right. So when we're talking about creme de la creme,
mm-hmm.
who are the best pastry chefs making pie?
One of them is Nicole Rucker. And she has been at various locations. She had a stand at Smorgasburg for a while. She's in the process of opening up what I believe will be a dedicated pie shop, which is just wildly exciting. She makes really interesting flavors. She had a citrus blackberry pie for a while. She's not afraid of doing wild flavor combinations with classical technique. And there's a reason that she has such a following, and that even though she only does pop-ups now, people will go to those pop-ups to eat Rucker's pies. They're very good. But if you want pie at the end of a maybe upscale, elegant sit-down meal, Republique on La Brea. Their pastry chef, Margarita Mansky, she was recently nominated for a James Beard Award for Best Pastry Chef, and pies are one of the excellent dishes that she makes.
Does she have a signature pie?
No, not a signature one, but she's not afraid to just make an apple pie.
What about Pie Hole?
Pie Hole is a good one, and they have multiple locations around Los Angeles, so that's mm-hmm. good. They're normally close to wherever you might be, and they do fun flavors. They have a lot of fun. They have sometimes do custard pies, Chess pies, but like have kid cereals in them, so like a Captain Crunch variety or Fruit Loops. So they're not traditional at all, but go into it like with a sense of whimsy, and I think you'll like it. There's another one sort of in the same vein called Atticus. They sell pie and ice cream, which I realized you hardly see any shops that specialize in pie and ice cream, even though the two obviously go perfectly together.
I mean, back to the apple pan, you get a big heap of vanilla ice cream with your pie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But maybe after a burger.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. If you go to Atticus, they have small single serving pies. And they, for instance, they'll use tropical fruits in their pies, perhaps a mango pie. And I think that that's really cool because that's so Southern California to, you know, smash the Asian and the European together into something that becomes even better than mm-hmm. we imagined before.
We haven't even talked about savory pies.
Sure. Well, you know, I have to say that I feel like that's an entirely different category. Because
it's savory?
Because it's savory.
It's a meal, not a dessert. Yeah.
And on a personal level, I do not care for savory pies.
Oh, I see. That's why we're not talking about
it. Yeah, pretty much. Ignore those.
You're just going to invite the ire of our listeners.
Oh, I'm a food writer. It's what I do. So yeah. I'm used to it.
Right. Okay. So what about the pie that looks the best that looks good on your Instagram?
of the Instagram. Well, back to Atticus, because they're using the tropical fruit flavors, they have a lot of really bright colors. It's perfect for Instagram. If you want to get a little yellow pie and a little pink pie and put them together and take a photo of it, you're going to get so many likes.
That's all that matters.
Yes.
The likes. Catherine Spires, food editor for the LA Weekly and host of the podcast Smart Mouth. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Christian Bordahl.
You know, Madeline Brand, how can Catherine Spires say she doesn't like savory pies?
I know.
That's crazy.
I love savory pies. So
shepherd's pie? A good chicken pot pie?
Shepherd's pie doesn't have pie crust.
Oh, so it's not really a pie. It's just like
mashed potatoes.
It's mashed potatoes, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's called a pie. It's called shepherd's pie. One thing I do agree with
mud pies are called pies.
Yes,
there's
no
crust.
I do agree with her that the banana cream pie from the Apple Pan is amazing.
Anything at the Apple Pan is amazing.
Yeah. So that's one area of agreement between myself and Catherine Spires, I guess.
All right. If you want to...
if everyone wanted to know.
Talk about their pie preference, we'd love to hear it. Our Facebook and our Twitter at KCRW Press Pop. I was going to say Press Pie. She changed the name of our show. KCRW Press Play. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brown. I'll see you tomorrow.